Thank you so much. It's just fine. With an introduction like that, I really just should say thank you and be seated most graciously. But since you did ask me to speak, I probably should share a few thoughts this morning. Yeah. I'd like to talk about three things with you this morning. First, to talk about what is this stuff, what is this thing we call diversity. We've heard some excellent introductions this morning. We've gotten some excellent insights into some of the powerful issues and challenges that we face around diversity. And I'd like to put a kind of a foundation in place for defining it. Second thing I want to talk about is a little more about the why. As human beings, hopefully we care about each other and the planet and the world, and we've heard some awful things happening in the media. We've heard some awful things happening over time described to us this morning. But I'd like to talk a little bit beyond just the human concerns and relate that to effectiveness, success as communities, and other sorts of dimensions. The last thing I'd like to talk about and engage you on is the whole topic of how can we address this huge challenge and opportunity that we face that stems from this thing we call diversity. And I hope to take at least a few minutes at the end of my sort of one-way conversation with you, and we'll have a little bit of interaction here, and to invite your questions and dialogue as we sort of conclude this part of our program for today. I want to begin in thinking about this thing we call diversity and share a short story about when I first came to Minnesota, which was in 1989. And I came to Minnesota as a director for human resources and Pillsbury Technology Center. Wonderful opportunity, wonderful organization, loved it, and was having a great time. And a young man came in to see me, and he says, I need to talk to the HR person. I says, come on in. He says, I think I'm doing okay in my job so far, but I'm real concerned about my long-term success in this organization. And I said, what's the problem? And he simply said three words. He said, my work group fishes. And I sort of hesitated and I said, excuse me? He says, my work group fishes. And I sort of laughed and I says, well, I love to fish too. What's the problem? He says, you don't understand. They fish when the ice melts. They fish when the ice freezes. They fish when we have a three-day holiday. And when they fish, they talk about work. Who's going to get the next special training opportunity? Who's going to go get to visit the plant? Who's going to get the next promotion in our group? All those sorts of things. And he said to me, and I don't fish. I don't even like fish. And because of that, I am excluded from all of those conversations. And so the conversation at that point took a very different, serious tone. And I said, oh, okay, well, I appreciate you sharing your concern with me, and I'll do some homework and get back to you. And so my first bit of homework consisted of looking up some Minnesota statistics, if you will. And there's a little tidbit that some of you probably know. If you walk down the street anywhere in the state and ask questions, excuse me, ma'am, are you registered to vote? Excuse me, sir, do you have a fishing license? Which question will you get more yes answers to? Absolutely. We didn't hear that statistic this morning, but there are more people who have fishing licenses than there are registered voters in the state. What kind of a sad state of affairs. And so I went back to the supervisor of that particular work group, and I said, you now have an additional responsibility. You must make this individual feel included. You must make him feel like he's a full-fledged member of the group, and rule number one is you may not force him to go fishing. And I labeled that as a diversity issue. And I says, I'm going to come back to you every 30 days, and I'm going to say, how's it going? Come back to the person who came to see me and say, are you feeling included? Are you feeling like you have equal opportunity as a member of this organization and this team? And so that was kind of a beginning for me. So I'd like to ask the question to start our morning, how many of us like to fish? If you just give me a show of hands, how many people like to fish? Okay, it's a very un-Minnesota group. You're going to have problems out there today. And so we'll talk about what that means. Also, I want to ask some kind of origin questions of us this morning as we sort of think about it. And my first one will have to do with kind of where in the world we were born. like to have everyone who was personally born outside of North America. If you were born outside North America, please raise your hand. Okay? So we have a little bit of diversity from folks born in different parts of the world. I'd like them to raise their hands again, and also to join them, everyone who has any parent born outside of North America. So personally born and have a parent born outside of America. Show of hands, okay? A little more here. Let's go back one more generation. Ask everyone who has either themselves, a parent, or grandparent born outside North America. Let's see a show of hands again, okay? Get more and more hands up. We're approaching or past the 50% point. You can see where I'm going. If we keep doing this over and over again, going back generations and generations, unless you happen to be Native American, pretty soon you're going to be raising your hand. We all came from somewhere, every one of us. And so just a little seed to plant around that. Let's look at another dimension. How many of us are parents? If you are a parent, please raise your hand. Okay? How many of us are not parents? Please raise your hand. Okay? Now, those who, hold it again, we need to take a poll here. Those of you who have your hands raised now, you are among the community of the not tired and not poor. So those of us who are parents, if you need a loan or assistance, go to the people who had their hands up, okay? So you know about those things, okay? How many of us speak two or more languages? Two or more languages, please raise your hand. Wonderful, absolutely wonderful. This is extraordinary. Most groups for most meetings in a variety of settings will have, in this country, fewer than 15% who will raise their hands and say they speak a second or a third language. And I want to put this into a little context. How many of you have ever traveled in the Netherlands? Anybody been to the Netherlands? Amsterdam, The Hague, any of those places? And as you roam about that country and look at the infrastructure, the roads, the buildings, the absence of people who are involuntarily homeless on the street, would you say that that's a fairly wealthy part of the world? How many would think it's a fairly wealthy country as a nation? Absolutely. And they get that wealth through Royal Dutch Shell, Unilever, Philips, and other major corporations who hire the average Dutch person, the average high school graduate or equivalent in that part of the world. And one thing that's very interesting about language in that part of the world, the average Dutch person speaks three or four languages well. If you are on the streets of Amsterdam and you're roaming around and you're lost and you walk up to a bus driver, a person in a shop, and you say, excusez-moi, parlez-vous français, the person will answer you in French. If you walk up to another person and you say, sprechen Sie Deutsch, they might look at you a little funny because there's still some stuff there, but they will answer you in German. Or if you say, hables español, you will still get some response. Or if you say, I'm lost, can you help me find the Rijksmuseum? They will say, yes, it's two blocks and three blocks this way. What happens is those average Dutch companies hire average Dutch people and perform in an outstanding way as they do business around the world. 15 million people in the Netherlands, 20 million speakers of Dutch as a primary language in the world, and they bring home a large disproportionate share of the world's wealth into that little tiny country called the Netherlands. And they do it with those multilingual, multicultural skills. And so as I look at that here, I want to think about that as an asset, as a powerful asset that can bring success to our state and to our communities, and want to position it that way. I just asked you a few questions about things that make us different and alike. And one of the things I want to go back and retrace some of that is to indicate all those questions I asked were about invisible kinds of things. You know, unless you see the little hook marks, you can't tell if people fish or not. But that's also a potential for being discriminated against in the workplace and in our communities. Because if you don't fish, are you left out of discussions? Are you left out of activities? Are you excluded in some fashion? If you are a person who is not a parent, and your organization needs somebody to work late, work weekends, travel, Are you the focus of that choice rather than the person who has a family, who should be home with their family, right? Make the single people travel. Make them work late. Make them work weekends and be discriminated against in that fashion. If you are a person who was not born here, well, opportunities are for real Americans, right? Not for people who were not born here, so we can discriminate against them. What if you speak English as a second language, and because of that, you have an accent? Well, obviously, if you have an accent, you're not very intelligent, right? Because if you could get rid of that accent, you would be more brilliant. And so we discriminate against a person on that fashion. Kind of see where I'm going? All of these things are invisible, not seen, but when detected, can be a basis for treating someone like a second-class citizen. And so I want to broaden our conceptualization of what happens in life and in our workplaces and schools and institutions and agencies. Continuing to build the same foundation and still on the what is it issue, I want to take us to what I see as the core of defining this thing we call diversity. And I want to do it using a process that I've used in probably 15 different countries and 7 different languages to get at what this thing is, because it is, unfortunately, as our speakers have indicated before me this morning, a universal and negative phenomena. And I want to begin by asking you a question. I'd like you to think about times in your lives when you've been with a large group of people. Only the group needs to be a group of people like yourself. Church, school, family, community, civic, sporting event, it doesn't matter. As long as it's a large group of people and you say, the people around me are like me. And I would like you to just share some of the one-word feelings that emerge as you think about, I'm going to get to be a part of that group. Let's imagine that we're going to happen tomorrow. What would the feelings be as you reflect on that event, that opportunity, that environment? Just to share some. Just kind of shout it out if you would. Safety. Safety, yes. What else?
Comfort.
Comfort. Home, yes. Peace.
Warmth.
Communication. Communication. What kind of communication? Yeah, good communication where there's that immediate connection, recognition. I say two words, you nod, and it's working, right? Any other feelings?
At ease.
At ease, inclusion. What does inclusion feel like? Feels that good, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Acceptance. Okay, excellent. How many of you are having, in general, positive feelings about those experiences? Okay, normal human phenomena. Anywhere in the world you ask that question, 95% of the responses will be along the lines that you just shared with me. I want you to sort of keep that in the back of your mind and shift now. I would like you to reflect on circumstances in your lives when, again, you've been with a large group, only this time you were the only person like you present. You were different from everybody around you. And for those of you who have enormous egos, you can simply take it from a perspective of, I walked into the room and noticed everyone was different from me. And as you think about going into those situations, as you step in and notice no one like you around, what are those initial feelings typically like?
Anxious.
Anxious. Discomfort.
Uncertainty.
Uncertainty.
Curiosity.
Curiosity.
Challenge.
Challenge. How else?
Cut off.
Cut off, yes.
Alienated.
Alienated.
Insecurity.
Insecurity, yes. How many of you in general, as your first reaction, are having negative, unpleasant, uncomfortable thoughts? Yeah. And again, around the world, when you ask that question, about 95% of the responses will be negative to that issue. Now, I want to just challenge our thinking a little bit. How many of you have been in situations with people just like yourselves, are similar to yourselves, nobody's just like you, but similar to yourselves and had bad experiences? Yeah? family reunion, other kinds of circumstances. It does happen. It's not the first thought that comes to mind, but it does happen. And again, how many of you have been in a situation where you were different? You were the only person like you, but it was, you were unique, you were special, you were treated in a positive way. How many have had those experiences? Absolutely, we've all had those experiences. Now, let me just test that for a minute though. Test that second one as well. We've all had good and bad experiences of difference, but let me just reaffirm the negative. How many of you have ever at any point in your lives had experiences that were uncomfortable when you were different? Just raise your hand. Okay, let me do the opposite. I'd like to have anyone who has never, ever in their life experienced being different that was negative to please stand. If you've ever had that experience, would you please stand? I'm still at no one standing here. There's usually at least one person. There is, you're the one person?
No, it's
no. Usually just one. And you know what happens with that one person? They usually stand up, I usually sit down, and we just wait. And usually in 10, 15 seconds or so, they start having those feelings and they sit down. You know, and we achieve sort of oneness at that point. It is a pretty universal experience. We all have it, and I want us to all use that as a foundation for learning about what it feels like, reflecting on what it feels like, and I also use that as a way of defining the goal and the vision for this work. Each and every one of us, in all our capacities in life, is responsible for creating an environment where everyone around us, everyone with whom we interact, in any capacity, feels the feelings typically associated with being with people like ourselves. Feelings of sameness. Not being the same, but feelings of sameness. That is the vision, that is the goal of this work. Not being the same, but having those feelings that we associate with it. And so our challenge in all of our institutions and communities is to create that set of feelings in everyone who resides in, lives in, learns in, works in, gets services from our organizations or our communities. That's the goal, that's the vision, and that's a process that you can use almost anywhere to make clear what it is we're talking about when we're talking about diversity and the vision and goal of this work. Let me just pause for 2 seconds and ask, anyone have a question about what it is that we're talking about in terms of diversity? All the ways in which we differ, visible and invisible, or a question about what it is we're trying to accomplish at a human gut feeling level?
I have a comment.
Please.
We were talking about the feelings when you're the only person of your race in a situation. Mm-hmm. Versus being with other, for me, other black people.
Okay.
And having bad experiences in both those situations.
Mm-hmm.
I want to point out to you that for me, the experience is never as bad with my own kind.
Mm-hmm.
The feeling of insecurity is never as bad,
mm-hmm,
as when I am the only African American in a setting with all white.
Yeah. Because there isn't that physical stuff, there isn't that emotional stuff, there isn't that hope. If it's a bad experience with people like yourselves, it typically comes from outside.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's a bad experience when you're different, it's in the room.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a different feeling. Yeah. And part of our perspective on this is, I hope, not the one reflected by a story a colleague of mine told about a large group of people, and this vicious animal comes into the room and literally starts, you know, ripping up people in the room, and pretty soon the animal, you know, has had enough and the animal leaves, and so the person goes around and bandages people and puts antiseptic on and ships them off for medical care and is very loving, warm, and caring, and is just the most wonderful, helpful person you can imagine. And then they come back for a meeting next week, and the animal's gotten the pattern. They know this group meets every Friday night, and so animal comes in again, tears up a bunch of people again. leaves, and the same loving, wonderful, caring person comes in and bandages them up, and you know, and helps them put medication on and sends them off for more medical care. And you know, and this keeps happening and happening and happening. And so one brilliant person said, you know, we really appreciate you coming to help us out when we're having these terrible events, but you know what we really need? Somebody to shoot this animal. You know, that's what we really need for help. So we just plug that in. Okay, any other issues around what is it that we're talking about? Okay, let's talk about why. Why is this so important? And we've heard some compelling, what I'll call human reasons this morning for why it's important in terms of pain, suffering, unfairness, and we'll touch on some of those as well. The first one I want to touch on is what I'll label as personal effectiveness. If you think about the people you know who are leaders, teachers, politicians, educators, almost in any capacity, the most effective individuals that I know are able to communicate and deal with people who are different from themselves, people who reflect a full range of styles, personalities, religions, races, approaches to life, and so on. And so for me, that's kind of an anecdotal statement. There's also, for those of you who want a more academic flavor, some very excellent research. A professor of mine who passed away some years ago, of the name of Stuart Cook. Stuart Cook actually did some of the research that backed up the Brown versus Board of Education decision with the Supreme Court. So a very well-known researcher. But what he did was to study what happens in environments that are diverse in terms of living, working situations. What happens to the people in those environments? If you go in and evaluate them, test them, third party, paper and pencil. And he basically said very clearly, individuals that learn to function in settings with people who are diverse get evaluated later as having better social skills, better interpersonal skills, better able to build relationships. And given the things we've heard earlier this morning, we certainly need people with those skills on the planet to address the issues that we are seeing today, both from young people and people of more mature ages who are doing all sorts of ugly things around the planet. And so from a personal effectiveness point of view, we need diversity. Let's look at social and demographic sorts of issues. You've got some data in your brochures there that talk about demographic change in Minnesota. And we know that if you go back to around the 1980 census, we had about 2% of the population being people of color in the state. You move that up to the 1990 census, it jumps to 6%. And you've got some speculation as to where it might be in the year 2000 for the census. You can also get a much richer picture. A colleague and I were talking this morning by looking in any public school in any major city in the state of Minnesota. And you will probably be shocked and amazed if you don't know the numbers, the percentage of students of color in our public schools. Clearly double digits. Clearly double digits. High double digits in the major cities. Smaller in our smaller communities, but nonetheless significant presence of students of color in our schools. That's a change, that's a difference. Are we going to, quote, waste those youth, or are we going to utilize their skills, capability, and potential in our communities and cities? Good question. Hopefully the answer is we will not have that wastage. Let's also talk about a concept called fairness and equity, but let's apply that concept to the well-being of our communities. I'd like to begin with, let's start with Levi Strauss, a company that's had some challenges in the last year or so. But over the years, Levi's has had a policy and a practice, really led by Bob Haas himself, the head of Levi Strauss. He said, we do not want to locate a plant in a community that has what he called a poor diversity climate, meaning lots of bad things happening across racial, religious, or other groups in a community. And some years ago, they learned that in the city of El Paso, Texas, there was some bad stuff going on. And so the company stepped in and did the following. It said, we don't want to have a facility in a location where bad things happen from a diversity point of view. So the company actually sponsored a large-scale conference and brought together all of the religious, community, business, educational leaders to spend 2 days working on what can we do in our community to change the climate around these issues. So that continues to be their policy and their practice to not do that. And so if we have communities that have bad things happen, we will not be a potential site for jobs and opportunities that will come with that kind of facility in our country, or in our particular community. Let's look at a statewide kind of thing. How many of you heard the story about what happened in Arizona some years ago with the Martin Luther King holiday? Yeah. The holiday was canceled. And what happened when the holiday canceled? What did the Super Bowl decide to do? Out of Arizona. Professional conferences and conventions, out of Arizona. Immediately, almost $750,000 of money immediately gone from the state that had been planned for, budgeted, if you will, by the small businesses and communities in Arizona, but didn't happen. After 3 years, their loss totaled $25 million of measurable loss of revenue that did not come into the state that would have come into the state. If they had waited 3 more years, that number would have been $300 million of lost revenue. They didn't lose $300 million because they did what? They reinstated the holiday. And their motivation was, of course, out of the goodness of their hearts, the right thing to do, right? The $300 million had nothing to do with it, right? That was just not material, as they say in the business sense. $300 million, I don't know about you, but that's pretty material to me. And so that sort of turned that around. Major sort of thing. Let's bring it right home to Minnesota. Between 1989 and mid-90s, we have the Final Four basketball tournament frequently. But during that time frame, we also had the Golf Open, Special Olympics, World Series, Super Bowl. And how much money do you think that brought to the state of Minnesota? Hundreds of millions of dollars? Easily hundreds of millions of dollars. And in talking with the city cabinets, Minneapolis, St. Paul, the county cabinets anyway, I asked the question, and they said hundreds of millions of dollars. And then I put the question on the table, what would have happened in our state if we had a reputation for hate crimes, civil disturbances, things of that sort? Where would all those events have gone? Somewhere else. And the money would have gone somewhere else. And so while this is, in part, an ethical, moral, feeling issue, I want to make sure that we all leave the room today understanding that failure to act proactively and successfully on these issues is a major economic detriment to the state. This is not soft stuff when we start talking about the impact of the diversity climate. It's not just the weather. It's about our economic well-being as a community. And it's powerful negative stuff if we don't address it appropriately. Let's also, while we're on the same theme, talk about what for some is a bigger driver. And that is, I'll call, organizational effectiveness. You know, a lot of organizations call me and they say, Robert, we need some diversity help. And I say, well, what are you trying to do? And they say, we want to have a diverse student population, a diverse faculty, diverse professionals in our agencies, or diverse employees. And I say, well, I'd like to help you out, but the best thing I can do is refer you to some folks who do a good job at recruiting, if that's what you're looking for. And I say, well, don't you do diversity work? I say, yes, I do. But my focus is on effectiveness, not just looking like the United Nations. I want us to look like the United Nations, but I want us to perform in an exceptional fashion. And so that's the direction, that's the kind of spin I want to put on it as I think about the effectiveness case. And so I want to go across a number of institutions. In the 1980s, I did some work for the Dallas County Community College System. And then I did some similar work in the same system in the state of Michigan. And there were 5 campuses in Texas. And we actually looked at each campus to look at student population, faculty population, and the change in enrollment over a period of about 5 years. And those campuses that proactively embraced diversity, meaning education, awareness, training, programs focused on these issues, actually saw their enrollments grow during the 5 year period. Those campuses who ignored diversity said, we have good programs, we have good standards, we're not going to get into this, saw their enrollments decline over the 5 year period. And I think we have also seen that pattern revalidated with recent data in the 1990s, 1997, 8, and 9. A couple of recent studies have looked at that and shown differences in how institutions that are educationally based perform if they don't pay attention to diversity. And enrollments is pretty a macro measure, but you know, most of us who work in those institutions get paid from student fees and tuition and those sorts of things, or from state funds that cover based on enrollment. So that's kind of an important dimension. Government agencies. We also know that if you are providing goods and services to a community, if you fail to provide goods and services to the entire community, what happens around election time? Yeah. We vote no for those resources. And so that can be an important aspect as well. What about not-for-profits? You think, well, they're not into making money. And let's look at the United Way as a not-for-profit organization. United Way of Minnesota, for example. Every year for the past 6 years, we've had, actually the Pillsbury Company has been so kind as to actually sponsor training for the United Way loan executives. And those are the folks who come from organizations and go out to communities to help raise funds for United Way. And what they've discovered is that if they as an organization do not understand the diversity issues, that they will not be as successful in raising the funds to pursue their mission. Therefore, even for a not-for-profit, paying attention to these issues is important in terms of diversity. It's a major, major, major issue, and so significant for us in the not-for-profit organizations. Business is easy, very easy. You've got two things going on in business that we can state very quickly. Businesses that don't recruit, retain, and develop a diverse workforce don't succeed in the diverse marketplace, period. And there are lots and lots of studies which demonstrate that, looking outward into the business arena. And if you look inside, which applies to all of our organizations, those of us who don't have a rich mix of people to do our work do two things. We make more mistakes and we miss opportunities. And let's talk about some of those kinds of mistakes. And these have been happening for years. Some are real classic that I think all of us should probably have in our back pocket. How many of you have heard the Gerber baby food story? How many of you have not heard the Gerber baby food story? Those of you who have heard it, should we tell them?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Gerber baby foods, a good number of years ago, decided to take its product to Africa. And what's on the jar of Gerber baby foods? What kind of baby? Beautiful white baby. He's chubby, cute, you know, all the right stuff for a baby. And so Gerber decided in its great wisdom to make some changes on that label if it was going to go into Africa. And if you were my marketing team, how would you advise me to change that label?
My name is Brett Muschat. I work with the Boys and Girls Club. My question is, how do we, and maybe if you can give some suggestions of how we get this information on diversity issues to the people that really are having a tough time understanding that there is a need for diversity. Obviously, it's easy for us to all sit in this room. We're here because we believe we need to attack the issues of diversity. How do we bring it to the community that really needs to hear this information? And to, for example, for the amount of kids that I work with, school officials that, you know, haven't been very receptive. How do we address that? Because again, we can have trainings on many different issues, but it's preaching to the choir. How do we get this to our communities?
Okay, two basic thoughts. One is the very direct way of conversation, communications, articles, media, etc., which is sometimes difficult because people will screen and filter that out if they're not interested. Secondly is the more indirect way, and that is, give an example. Month or so ago, there was several pages in USA Today about kids graduating from high school and those who had high grade points, high test scores, and so these are the future leaders, problem solvers for the world. And if you look at, just look at the picture, that picture is a very diverse picture. And so for an educator to look at that picture, there has to be some response that says, if this is the finest talent that the U.S. is developing, boy, there are some kids in this picture that look like some kids in our school that I don't think about in this way. The other is constantly, indirectly associating excellence with diversity. One of my favorite pictures from an annual report in a company was a photograph that I encouraged our company to put in the annual report. And here's the picture. There is a woman, brown-skinned woman, happens to be Persian. There are people in the picture of various ages, colors, gray hair, black hair, style, and it's just a picture. There's nothing but a name under the picture. There's nothing that says anything about diversity, but it's clearly a diverse group. And under the picture is a description of what this team has done for the organization in the last 12 months. Patents, new products generated, revenues enhanced for the company, et cetera, et cetera. So every time you can present an image in your newspapers, media, that says, here is a team of folks, click, here is what this team of folks did for our institution. Won awards, won recognitions, got publications out, delivered high quality services, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We are sending that message that diversity is one with excellence, not separate from it. And that's probably the more powerful strategy, and that takes some leadership from those who are creating those images and some guidance to those who are creating those images. And so that's one recommendation for addressing that.
Again, I'd like to thank Dr. Hales.